You're listening to Minding the Brain with Dr. Kim Hellemans and Dr. Jim Davies. Episode 95, Sound Meaning in Language.
Hello, today we have David Sidhu, who's an assistant professor at the Carleton University Department of Psychology. So today we're going to talk about certain aspect of language. Now, when you are the native speaker of a language, sometimes it feels like the words and their meanings are somehow appropriate. Like the sound of the word has something to do with what it means. Like the sound of the word hard has something to do with hardness. But then linguists often say that for the most part, this isn't true, and that the sound of words are kind of arbitrary. But then there's a branch of science that says that maybe the sound of words aren't so arbitrary after all. David, would you like to introduce this topic?
Yeah, well, thank you for having me, first of all. So general name for this is sound symbolism. Like you say, it's kind of the idea that the sounds we use in language have some inherent meanings or associations with them. So the classic example is something called the Bubakiki effect, or Maluma Tikiti, depending on who you want to credit. But it's the idea that if you imagine one kind of globular round shape and one spiky shape, and you're told one of these is a buba, one's a kiki, everyone kind of shares the intuition that the round shape is the buba, the spiky shape is the kiki, which shows that even though these are meaningless invented words, something about the sound in them, or maybe their feeling as you say them, evokes feelings of roundness or spikiness. So they have these...
When you say almost everybody, is it like, what are we talking, like 90% or...
Yeah, about 90%, I would say. Yeah. That's one of the recent things I saw. And there are studies testing this across different languages. So the biggest one I've seen is by Alexandra Swiak, and she studied it in about 20 languages. And it basically showed up in all of them except for three, if I remember correctly. So it's pretty broad, pretty general.
Was this the start of sound symbolism?
No, it actually goes back a long time. So, I mean, if you want to go all the way back, Plato talked about it in the Cratylus dialogue. But most people point to 1929, a paper by Wolfgang Kohler. And he made the suggestion that if you show people these two shapes and you say one's a maluma, one's a tikiti, everyone will share that intuition. So that's generally what people point to as the starting point, this 1929 book.
Okay, and then was there like a fallow period, or did have people been doing it continuously since the 20s?
Yeah, there was a lot of interest in it in the 50s and 60s. But then between then and about the year 2000, there wasn't that much. And then a paper by Ramachandran and Hubbard kind of rekindled interest. That's where the Bubakiki effect comes from. They talked about this effect called the Bubakiki effect. And since then, it's been gaining popularity.
Well, so you said there's a lot in the 50s and 60s, but what weren't like the 50s or the early 50s when linguistics really got started with Chomsky?
Yeah, well, an interesting thing there is there's always been these two branches of work on this, some by psychologists. So Wolfgang Kohler was a Gestalt psychologist. Mm-hmm. And then there's also been a branch in linguistics. So yeah, I think it's kind of been happening in parallel. And more recently, the two sides are coming together.
But am I correct in that this kind of the standard linguistic approach is that the sounds are mostly arbitrary? Is that correct? Or am I mischaracterizing linguists?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of nuance there. So if by arbitrary we mean that you could use any collection of sounds to refer to anything in the world, I think that is true. I think everyone would agree with that. But if by arbitrary we mean that the sounds of words don't have any impact on their interpretation, I think that's where it seems like language isn't entirely arbitrary.
Okay. All right. And how did you get into this field?
Yeah, I remember it was in undergrad, and I can't remember if it was intro or my cognitive psychology class. There was like a little figure about the Bubakiki effect in my textbook. And yeah, that just kind of captured my imagination. It's one of those things that once someone tells you about it, once you find out about it, you start seeing it everywhere in the world around you. So that just happened to me. And then once I got into grad school, I was really interested in embodied cognition and how bodily sensations affect cognition. And so that was a nice angle into this, thinking about how when you pronounce sounds, when you're speaking, you're kind of, you have these embodied sensations of moving your tongue, moving your lips, And so my first interest in this was, does the feeling of words shape their meaning? And I've kind of got away from that since, but that was my entry point.
Okay, so I think I've heard some things about like how GL at the beginning of a word is sound symbolic for reflected or diffracted light or something, like glare, glow, glimmer or something. Do you know about this example?
Yeah, so those are phonesthemes. They're like sound clusters that tend to occur in words with related meanings. So GL is a famous one. So gleam, glisten, glow appears in words for light, like you say. Another one is SN at the start of a word in things to do with the nose or the mouth. So like sneeze, snore, sniff.
Mm-hmm.
And some of those seem to be sound symbolic in the sense that they kind of evoke their meanings. Like this SN, it involves a nasal sound, it refers to the nose. The GL one is a bit more arbitrary or harder to motivate that one.
I understand. Like it's hard to think of how a sound could mean light reflected or whatever. But is that a cross-cultural finding? And do you think that there's some bodily relationship that we simply haven't discovered yet? Or do you think it's just a pattern the GL, for example?
I think phonesthemes tend to be language specific.
Okay.
But a lot of these associations are more language general, like the ones that are based in some kind of bodily experience or sound association, those seem to show up across languages. A really nice example of this is the R sound, especially a trilled R, like a R, that shows up in a lot of languages in words for rough.
Oh, okay.
And that's got a nice, clear bodily motivation, right?
Yeah, and isn't there also one for B or BR for like break or burst? It's like a something that starts suddenly?
Possibly. I don't know that one, but that
makes sense to me. Okay. And then there's one for fringes or thresholds that have like a esh or an inj.
Oh, okay.
Sound like that. So there's kind of like, to me, it seems like the ish sounds like there's no clear ending to it, which is
right.
Sort of like symbolic for like a fuzzy boundary.
Yeah, that's funny. It fits with that as a morpheme.
Yeah. And I think people can relate to this a bit. You know, there's, I read fantasy fiction where people are making up words all the time. And, it really doesn't feel arbitrary at all. You know, you give a demon a different name from a cute little house elf or something like that, you know.
Yeah, Tolkien was actually really into this. He actually wrote an essay on sound symbolism.
Oh, really?
So when he made up his elvish languages, he used certain sounds to evoke, you know, light and smoothness. I think it was Tom Bombadil, and he talks about how that name just kind of evokes a happy person bounding over the hills. That's a nice example of sound symbolism.
Right. And he's got a hobbit named Bomber. Or no, a dwarf. A dwarf named Bomber.
Bomber,
who's
a
bit of a bumbling clown, right?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
What are you specifically working on in your lab?
Yeah, there's a bunch of things happening right now. So one of my main interests is thinking about how these associations between sounds and meaning affect language processing. So it's fun to detect these associations with invented words. I think the real key is now to show, does this affect how people process language or think about language? So we've done some studies looking at words that sound like their meaning. They're called iconic words versus non-iconic words. And it seems like people can process them faster and more accurately. So something in that link between sound and meaning makes that meaning easier to retrieve, which I think is very cool.
And of course you control for things like commonality and those
They're matched on frequency and length and all those kinds of things. And we've just recently found that this seems to be especially important in expressions of emotion. So there are certain sounds that people associate with really exciting things. So these are sounds like ka or higher pitch vowels. And when you have a word with a really exciting meaning and someone's exciting sounds, people also process those faster. And vice versa also, if you have a word for something calming and it contains smoother, softer sounds, people also process those faster.
Okay. And are these are findings you're building on?
Yeah, those are our findings from the lab, yeah.
Oh, those are your findings? Oh, okay, great. So you're doing like word recognition tasks?
Yeah, exactly.
Decision tasks?
Exactly, yeah. We've also started looking at it in memory. So it seems to do funny things in memory where you have, if you give people a recognition task where they learn 50 iconic words, 50 non-iconic words, and then they're shown a bunch of words and they're asked, did you see this word before? They're better at recognizing the iconic words they've seen before, but they also false alarm more often to iconic words. Mm-hmm. So there's something funny happening there.
So I'm going to get all cognitive science-y on you for a second. Like, do you have like a information processing theory of why this happens?
I don't, but I think there's a lot of room to think about it in that way. Did you have an idea?
Well, one is just the more cues you have for retrieval, the easier the retrieval is, right? So if like a GL sound makes you think of reflected or refracted light, then by the time you get to the end of the word, you've already primed and activated all of the words that have to do with light, including anything that starts with GL, right? So having a term for when the sound is anti-meaning?
Yeah, anti-iconic.
Anti-iconic,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So we did, yeah, that slows people down, it seems like. So if you have, let's say, an exciting word with calm sounds, that slows people down.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So yeah, it seems like there could be kind of like a spreading activation.
Yeah, that's right? Kind of the angle I've thought of too. That the sound of the word activates certain meanings that are associated in that way.
Yeah. And what are some other people doing in this world that you find interesting?
Yeah. So people are kind of digging into the underlying mechanisms at play. So there's a really nice recent study by Matilda Fort and Jean-Luc Schwartz, which look to see if maybe the reason we associate some sounds with round and spikiness is that round and spiky objects in the real world make those kinds of sounds.
Right.
So they actually recorded round things rolling on a table, spiky things rolling on a table. And if you look at the acoustic properties of either shape, that kind of matches the phonemes that people associate with either kind of shape.
Is that what they found?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I'm interested also in these broader metaphors, like why do we refer to high pitches as high?
Yeah.
And low pitches as low. And one theory I saw is that things that are low to the ground tend to make lower pitch sounds when struck.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
so,
very cool.
Yeah. It could be something like that. So I guess this acoustic theory, striking acoustic theory, is somewhat in contrast with the shape of the mouth kind of theory?
Yeah. The problem with all these features of phonemes is they're also highly correlated. So if something changes in sound, it's going to change in articulation as well. So it's hard to tease those apart. So I don't know if they're necessarily in contrast, but they're highlighting different aspects of the sound, let's say.
Well, I mean, in contrast in that they both might be contributing, but they are separate, even if they tend to be correlated kind of.
Yeah, thing, right? Yeah. Definitely.
But what you're saying sounds like it's hard to control these things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I did once. There are certain phonemes that you can articulate in different ways, but they sound the same. So like the sound in bird, for example, you can make that sound by bunching your tongue at the back of your mouth or having the front of your tongue kind of flap upwards.
Oh, so we
compared people with either kind of articulation, but there wasn't an effect there. But that was a neat case.
How did you measure which one they were doing?
It was a really awkward task where you have to stick a straw in their mouth. So they make a sound, keep their tongue there. And then if you put a straw in their mouth, they put the straw in their mouth. We didn't do it. They put a straw in their mouth. And if it touches the bottom versus the top of the tongue, that tells you how they're articulating it.
So they report where it's touching?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. Wow.
They hated it. Yeah. We didn't, we stopped that pretty quickly. Yeah.
Oh, at least they were putting the straw in, right?
Yes. Yeah. I'm also looking at how this can apply to other dimensions. So shape is well studied, size is well studied. One of the things I've been looking at is personality. So we find that sounds in a name seem to generate expectations about a person's personality. So like if I tell you to think of a Molly versus a Kate, and who do you think is the kinder, more easygoing person, you probably say...
I would say Molly.
Yeah, that's what we find. So those softer names, people think they're going to be kinder, more easygoing. The harsher names, people tend to think they're more extroverted.
Yeah.
More outgoing. Yeah.
Do you remember the joke in Pulp Fiction about this?
No, what is it?
It's, the boxer's named Butch. And the foreign taxi driver says, "What does Butch mean?" He's like, "Names don't mean anything."
That's good. Yeah, and so that is funny because we did actually collect people's personalities, and the names didn't mean anything. They weren't related to their personalities.
Okay, so they're related to reputations of personalities, but not actual personalities.
Exactly. So if you get a name in isolation, you kind of have expectations about what a Molly's going to be like, but it doesn't actually seem like Mollies are any kinder.
Yeah. What would you say are some of the unsolved problems of this field?
Yeah. So the impact of the language that you speak, I think, is a big open question. So even just replicating these kinds of effects across languages is something new. And then a question that comes out of it is, you know, if you have a lot of words in your language referring to round things that have round sounds in them, is that shaping these associations? Do the sounds in your language shape these associations? That's a big one. The question of how this all plays out in the brain, that's a huge question that we don't have a lot of insight into yet, but there's cool work on that. And then I think a big question, this is kind of the golden question, is how this affects language evolution and language change, which is obviously a difficult thing to answer. But some people would say that these kinds of associations affected the earliest stages of language. And, you know, if you want to...
Early in history or early in development?
History. So development, we do know that for sure. Yeah, that iconic words are learned earlier, but that the earliest impetus for language might have been to use sound to imitate things in the world. People have made that case.
Right. Okay.
Very hard to test, obviously.
Yeah. These they are hard. So words are always being invented. And one lens you could have on it is sort of a mimetic or evolutionary lens where words get introduced for certain things and they get accepted or not based on some fitness, whatever that is. Has there been speculation about how, like, words that are iconic are a little more sticky or more adaptive in an evolutionary, in a language evolution?
Yeah, that is kind of the argument, that they have some sort of survival advantage. If they're a little bit easier to process, a little bit easier to learn, they might stick around a bit more. And there have been these cool studies, these iterated learning studies, where a participant comes in, they're taught 20 invented words for 20 invented shapes, let's say, and then they recall them, they make mistakes, but the 20 words as they recalled them get taught to the next participant, and so on and so on. So language kind of changes throughout generations. And there's some evidence that it becomes slightly more iconic over time through these kinds of mistakes.
That's amazing. That's totally cool.
Yeah, that's cool work.
So tell me, what do you plan to do in the future with your lab?
Yeah, so continuing some of the questions I've talked about here. So getting a clearer sense of how this affects language processing. And then this whole avenue of looking at names, I think, is wide open. And I want to do a lot of things here. So, you know, it seems like Mollies aren't actually more friendly, but does having the name Molly affect a person in their life at all? Like, if it affects your first impression, is that going to change things? If you're just submitting a resume without much other information, is that going to affect your perception? So questions like that. Getting at these underlying mechanisms of what really ties these sounds to these shapes, it's something I still want to look at. And then how all these things fit together. Like, there's like 20, 30 different associations that have been found. So I'm really curious if these are all distinct associations or if they kind of cluster. Like, is what makes a sound seem small, seem fast, seem bright, is that all one larger effect, or are these really separate things?
Yeah, and another thing that might be interesting to look at is what is going on in parents' minds when they choose a name.
Yes.
Right? Yes. Like, are they being arbitrary when they do it? I mean, of course, naming after your grandmother is one thing, but you know, if they care about kindness, are they more likely to pick Molly? You know,
that's interesting.
Like,
yeah.
You could ask pregnant couples, you know, like, what are you hoping for your child? You know, and see what they end up naming their kid.
I like that. Yeah. Yeah. Cause it's hard to see what they're picking up on in the kid, but if it's sort of aspirational, that's interesting.
Yeah. Or I don't know, maybe somebody's already done research on how parents pick names for kids, you know, but, it could be that, the phonosemantics is affecting that. Now, so then, like, if let's say that the parents really care about kindness and everything like that, they might both pick a kind iconic name and also raise their kids to be kind.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So it'd be interesting to try to tease apart the influence of the name itself as opposed to the common cause.
For sure.
Of kind.
But even just looking at that motivation would be really interesting.
Yeah, that'd be great. All right. Well, thank you so much, David. This is I've always found this a totally fascinating project and or a field. And thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
People want to learn a little more. Where would you recommend they start?
Okay, so I am on Blue Sky at David M. Sidhu, SIDHU, and my lab's website is ClassyLab, ClassyLab.ca.
Okay, and people can find your papers and stuff there.
Yeah, they're all there.
Super. Well, thank you so much for coming, and it was a real pleasure.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Minding the Brain is gratefully sponsored by Carleton University's Faculty of Science and Language, without which this podcast would be a half hour of snorts and grunts. If you find this show valuable and you want to support Minding the Brain, consider leaving us a review or rating on your podcast app of choice. Leaving a review or rating increases our visibility and helps new listeners discover the show. You can find us on TikTok and Instagram at Minding the Brain, and you can find us on YouTube at Minding the Brain Podcast. You can also find more episodes and show notes at our website, mindingthebrainpodcast.com. Thank you for listening to Minding the Brain.